Within a week, the state finally capitulated, and I finally felt we were on the same page, using the same numbers and the same words. The turning point came when Eden Wells told the Detroit Free Press that lead exposure was population-wide in Flint and not limited to a few dozen children. From a public health perspective, she said it was important to consider the whole cohort who had been exposed to drinking water, especially kids 6 and under who had been consuming the water since April 2014. The number 43 vanished as mysteriously as it had arrived. All the kids in Flint had to be regarded as exposed, according to Eden, regardless of what their blood level is today. That was a victory. The future for the kids in Flint came down to a few coded words, whole cohort, and regardless. Without a shared understanding of the problem, that all children needed to be protected and treated, whether or not they had problems or will ever have problems, we couldn't hope to arrive at solutions that would help everyone. Shortly after taking office, Flint's new mayor, Karen Weaver, declared a citywide state of emergency. She had no formal power to do it, but around a small room, many of us urged her on, including a newly hired emergency responder for the county. And it worked. The declaration had a ripple effect and caused a new flood of media attention, forcing Governor Snyder to declare an emergency in Genesee County a few weeks later, which got the National Guard on the ground to distribute bottled water and filters, and which prompted President Obama to declare a federal emergency in Flint on January 16, 2016. Being declared a disaster would have been better and freed up even more resources, but it turned out that would have required a natural disaster, like a fire, flood, or earthquake. It made me mad, since the potential consequences of the lead exposure are far longer lasting. Nevertheless, the federal emergency declaration was a big deal. For the most part, the feds knew what they were doing. It was no longer amateur hour. They understood the scope of the impact, and I never had to explain what toxic stress was. They got it, and they tried. Dr. Nicole Lurie, a seasoned physician and a uniformed U.S. Public Health Service officer, took charge and coordinated the response from every acronym agency imaginable. FEMA, HHS, SBA, EPA, CDC, HUD, SAMHSA, and more. By then, Jenny, Kirk, and I had been working on a list of interventions for a couple of months. I had looked at studies, research programs, and called national lead experts, child development experts, and toxic stress and resilience experts. We wanted to recommend programs that had been tested and were proven to work. We let science tell us the best ways to protect children, promote their development, and improve their outcomes. This is what kids need everywhere, but especially Flint kids. Most important, we needed to get them better food and nutrition. A child fully loaded with certain nutrients, especially iron and calcium, is less likely to have ongoing lead absorption and lead settling long-term in their bones. We needed to make sure every child in Flint had a regular pediatrician or medical home where they could be treated and their progress reported. This medical home could check children's development and coordinate with all the other programs and help direct families toward other programs like home visiting, breastfeeding and parenting support, early literacy, mental health, and transportation access. The list kept growing. Kirk and I polished it, rewrote it, looked it over and over. We got it down to 7 pages, so it was easy to read, the interventions organized by category, then prioritized. We hoped that it would make a difference. And then I got the idea to add a registry to the list, a registry of everyone exposed to the crisis, like the one for the victims of the PBB contamination in 1973, when 9 million Michiganders had been exposed to a toxic flame retardant chemical that causes permanent hormone disruption. Another prime example is the World Trade Center Health Registry, used for victims of 9/11, now the largest registry in the United States to track health effects of a disaster. Like those, the Flint Registry had to include people who had moved out of the city, but our focus would be improving outcomes and supporting victims, not just monitoring. It would be a way to make sure that everyone was able to benefit from the advantages and resources that I was going to fight for, and I hoped would come. Our document wasn't just a list of demands on behalf of Flint Kids. It was also a roadmap to intervention, throwing together everything that we knew worked for kids. And with it in hand, we hoped to enable government and donors to know exactly what was at stake and what could be expected. We were already almost 2 years behind for Flint Kids. 2 years of critical brain development had passed while they were consuming lead regularly. Whenever I thought of that, a sense of urgency took over, and I became single-minded about getting these programs funded and in place. As the media focus on Flint sharpened, and I had more chances to speak out, I saw an opportunity. As the saying goes, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. It wasn't enough for me to give interview after interview explaining how horrible the state's actions had been, how tragic lead is for children, and how scary the implications were. More could be accomplished with a slightly different perspective from these scare and doom tactics. And that was to provide a sense of hope. And it was with hope and a commitment to justice that MSU and Hurley stood beside me and helped me create something new. A model public health program to bring hope and healing to Flint. Coming up with that plan was like building an airplane in midair. But without a moment of hesitation, MSU's Dean Dean and Aaron Sousa, along with Melanie at Hurley, helped me put it together. MSU made it clear that they would spare no effort to tackle the crisis. Our list of interventions grew and came to include continued advocacy, robust evaluation, and a promise to share our best practices with other struggling communities. By this time, the immense generosity of people in the United States had been directed at Flint. Truckload after truckload of bottled water was delivered, sent by Girl Scouts in Ohio, UAW locals in Chicago, a ballroom dance club in Ann Arbor. Union plumbers volunteered countless hours installing and replacing filters and joined the campaign to replace our nation's millions of lead pipes. The outpouring was tremendous, but soon we'd need more than bottled water. We would need an investment in the tomorrows of our children. Knowing that some of the effects of lead exposure might not be seen for 10 years or more, Representative Kildee started talking about setting up a health fund of some kind, separate from the interventions that we were recommending. In a small meeting, we decided that the best and most transparent place to house this kind of fund would be a community foundation. Kirk and I drafted the framework for a tomorrow fund with a 20-year time frame. We created an advisory committee established at the Community Foundation of Greater Flint, and I became the founding donor. We called it the Flint Child Health and Development Fund, flintkids.org, with a goal of raising $100 million. In January, once Flint had gained federal emergency status, we officially submitted our comprehensive, science-based list of recommendations to the Emergency Operations Center. That is, we literally put this plan in front of everybody, the city, the state, and eventually the governor. Then we put it in front of the federal government. This is what Flint kids need, we said. This is what has to be done. Chapter 25, Truth and Reconciliation. In early February 2016, I was sitting in the clinic, trying to catch up on my backlog of work, when four Michigan State police officers barged in. They had earpieces and dark suits and said the governor was going to pay me a visit. But before he arrived, a team of guys with wands and all kinds of security gizmos swept and examined every nook and cranny of the clinic. What the hell? Most of the staff was shocked, but Arabs are used to this special attention. Governor Snyder didn't come alone. He was joined by a posse. Lieutenant Governor Brian Calley, who was in Flint a few days a week by then, MDHHS Director Nick Lyon, and two indistinguishable top-level aides. Hurley is a diverse place, lots of women, lots of people of color, and a lot of white doctor coats. Now my tiny office was suddenly very crowded with dark suits, worn by five guys who were very tall and very white. Somewhere down near the floor were me and my medical student, Joe. I felt like Bilbo Baggins when the dwarves keep showing up for the unexpected party at the beginning of The Hobbit. The governor started off with an apology. By then, he had been doing a lot of that. 3 days after President Obama declared a federal emergency in Flint, the governor had apologized to the people of Flint in his annual State of the State address. He'd even used the words toxic stress and activated the National Guard to distribute water. A few days later, he returned some executive power to Mayor Weaver. Apologies are easy, however, and in Flint, they were starting to come pretty cheap. The minute I started hearing one, I thought, I don't care about your apology. I care about action. I cared about getting enough funding and the interventions and how things would work out for the kids of Flint for the next few decades. I would have to work with this governor and many governors to come. As he apologized, I looked him right in the eye. Governor Snyder had genuine remorse and regret in his voice. He was visibly shaking. I thought he might cry. But he steadied himself and continued. He said he was about to announce the new state budget and wanted to tell me his plans for Flint. The state budget director was on speakerphone. Almost everything I asked for, my entire list of demands, all the wraparound services for the kids that I had recommended, were in some shape or form in the budget. Nutrition, education, health. That meant enhanced meals at school. That meant medical home access for all families and children. Even more support would come from the federal government when it granted Flint a Medicaid waiver. That would mean more school nurses, 10 for the city instead of just one. That would mean nurse-family partnerships, home visiting, universal early intervention, school-based health centers, preschools, and expanded pediatric behavioral health access. More than $100 million of the Michigan budget would be dedicated to Flint kids. This is the stuff progressives dream about but never get. This is what Alice Hamilton fought to build, wraparound services, when she worked at Hull House. It wasn't long-term money, forever money. A binding budget can't be forced on future legislatures. But it would begin to help Flint kids now. It was a big deal. I was truly thrilled and surprised. And I thanked Governor Snyder. It was a good start. Then he had a favor to ask. He didn't exactly put it that way, but that's what it was. He wanted to know if I could attend a press conference the following week when the budget was announced. I knew what that meant. More trophy time. My earlier head-shaking episode had given me even more credibility. Now he hoped I would stand next to him in public and absolve him of wrongdoing or negligence. If I appeared to forgive him, maybe everybody else would. Fortunately, I had a legitimate excuse to say no. I was going to be tied up in D.C. that day. I was called to testify about the Flint water crisis to a joint committee of Congress. I was very relieved it worked out that way, even if I was thrilled that he'd gone along with most of our demands and suggestions. Prior to the crisis, Snyder had been popular and had even been considering a presidential run. His fall from grace had been sudden and steep, and completely a result of Flint. His administration had ignored so many red flags. His staff and appointees had ignored the activists' loud and sustained protests. They had ignored the concerns of health professionals and water treatment experts. They had chosen to look the other way. And when faced with the results of their own apathy and negligence, they had tried to cover up. If I had to locate an exact cause of the crisis, above all others, it would be the ideology of extreme austerity, and all government is bad government. The state of Michigan didn't need less government, it needed more and better government, responsible and effective government, and people who are not being poisoned by the tap water. For decades, the city and state infrastructure had been neglected in order to save money. State environmental and health agencies had been defunded, and great public servants had become disillusioned and retired, leaving these agencies a shadow of what they were supposed to be. All the budget cuts and so-called fiscal responsibility had resulted in a winner-take-all culture, a disdain for regulations and career regulators, a rubber stamping of bad ideas, a gross underfunding of environmental enforcement, limited understanding of and expertise in public health, and a disregard for the poor. Snyder's people tried to be good at PR, but in the end, they even failed at that. The implementation of the EM law was the deciding factor. Evidence of contempt for Flint and its poor residents, as if they were sub-citizens who didn't deserve a fair say or vote. Years before the water switch, members of the state's Black Caucus in Congress had asked the Justice Department to review the constitutionality of the EM law. Though they were ultimately unsuccessful, residents of cities taken over by emergency managers fiercely argued that the EM law violated the Voting Rights Act, since it subjected more than half of Michigan's African-American voters to emergency management in their schools or cities. Everybody knows that this water crisis would not have happened in predominantly white Michigan cities like West Bloomfield or Grosse Pointe or Ann Arbor, Michael Moore wrote in Time. Everybody knows that if there had been 2 years of taxpayer complaints and then a year of warnings from scientists and doctors, this would have been fixed in those towns. This is a racial crime. If it were happening in another country, we'd call it an ethnic cleansing. About a month after my press conference, Governor Snyder named 5 men to a Flint water task force. When I first heard about it, I was skeptical. Not just because they couldn't bother to find a single woman, but because naming a blue ribbon committee is a time-honored way to solve a political nuisance. But I was reassured to hear that Dr. Reynolds was on the task force, and that it would be co-chaired by former state representative Chris Kolb, an environmentalist and also a student of Bunyan Bryant. Kolb had been prematurely expelled from public service because of Michigan's stupid term limit law. I started calling it the Five Guys Committee, and not long afterward, the task force informally adopted that name for itself. It was charged with reviewing actions regarding water use and testing in Flint, and asked to offer recommendations for future guidelines to protect the health and safety of all state residents. The Five Guys took their mission seriously, probably more seriously than the governor intended, and in March 2016 released a kick-ass 112-page report. It fixed blame for the failure of government primarily on MDEQ. But it didn't spare the governor, the emergency managers, or the MDHHS. The report stated very clearly that the demographics of a community, race, had played a role in creating this environmental crisis. And it stated that race had kept the crisis going long after it should have been stopped. The Five Guys explicitly connected the Flint water crisis to the emergency manager law. And in this way, the report was historic. Never had a government report explicitly stated the role of race in an environmental crisis. And never before had the consequences of the loss of democracy been so keenly demonstrated. Flint may be the most egregious modern-day example of environmental injustice. Later, in February 2017, the Michigan Department of Civil Rights made similar findings in its own investigation. Another father of environmental justice, Robert Bullard, once said that some communities have the wrong complexion for protection. That is how I see it, too. Flint falls right into the American narrative of cheapening black life. White America may not have seen the common thread between Flint history and these tragedies, but black America saw it immediately. That the blood of African American children was unnecessarily and callously laced with lead speaks in the same rhythm as Black Lives Matter, a movement also born from the blood of innocent African Americans. Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Sandra Bland, Freddie Gray, also a victim of lead poisoning, Alton Sterling, Tamir Rice. At a January 2016 rally, Jesse Jackson called Flint a crime scene. I guarantee you, if it was any of my homeboys, my friends, they'd be in handcuffs right now. Think about it. How many African Americans and others are in jail for the most minor offenses? Simple assaults, minor burglaries, bail violations, drug crimes. One in three African-American men will be incarcerated at some point in their lives. Too many. It's racially driven mass incarceration. Yet I won't be surprised if relatively little jail time is served by anyone for the Flint mess, even though it could measurably alter 8 to 10,000 kids' lives. I was prepared for years of battle and denials. I never thought the governor or his administration would be capable of comprehending and accepting the charge of willful negligence, or would ever do anything about it. But I was wrong. When faced with data that could not be ignored and the full weight of the crisis, the protesters, and the media onslaught, he got his act together. Though his words were stilted, too slow, and never robust enough, his deeds and the deeds of his administration deserve some respect. I'm wise enough to know that Brad Werfel and others got their marching orders from higher up, possibly all the way up. I also know that most people, except for megalomaniacs like Saddam Hussein, don't wake up in the morning saying, "I want to poison thousands of people." Admitting your mistakes and then doing what you can do to rectify them takes integrity and strength. And in the end, I felt the governor cared and was truly sorry. This gave me hope because a man who cares and feels sorry might do more for Flint kids to rectify his mistakes than a politician with less at stake. Even if he didn't care and wasn't sorry, he knew that the balance of his political career would be judged by his response to this crisis. That's why, rather than seeking retribution or political advantage, I decided to remain loyal to only one group, Flint kids. I will do whatever it takes to help them and to keep on helping them, even if it means working with people whose ideology and actions got us into this mess. At the end of my meeting with the governor, he asked for my blessing, and I gave it to him. 4 months later, in June 2016, after a lot of dogged advocacy, the Michigan State Legislature, following the lead of Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick, passed the budget. The three state budget supplements, passed at three different times, totaled about $200 million in aid for Flint. It would take another 6 months of coalition building, roller coaster ups and downs, and trips to D.C., more than a year after the crisis was exposed, before a Flint aid package finally passed in the U.S. Congress, with much thanks to the stubborn efforts of Congressman Dan Kildee and Senators Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters, as well as Congressman Fred Upton, a Republican from Western Michigan. The advocacy life is like that. One day a victory, the next day a crushing disappointment, and the next another victory. I didn't meet Miguel del Toro until he came to town in March 2016. We had emailed and talked on the phone, but we had never met until just after President Obama declared the federal emergency, paving the way for more EPA resources and intervention. So our meeting came at a happy moment in the glow of one of those victories. We were all supposed to have dinner, Mark Edwards, Leanne Walters, Miguel, and me. But Miguel was stuck in his hotel room with severe back pain. We all had gone through dark nights of the soul as advocates for Flint. But the efforts to silence and ruin Miguel for his whistleblowing and his being dismissed, having to leak his own memo, and being sent to the EPA ethics office had taken a toll on him physically. He could barely stand, let alone walk. So we all went up to his hotel room, just to say hello. I really wanted to meet him, to thank him, to hug him. When we were introduced, Miguel leaned over and kissed me on the forehead, the endearing way you'd greet a child. I still remember the way that felt and how sweet it was. In a photograph that we took together, we are holding him up and helping him stand. When we helped him sit again, I noticed that his feet were bare and his toenails were painted. Throughout the crisis, his wife had complained that Miguel was so consumed by the Flint water, so infatuated with lead pipes, that he had stopped listening to her and couldn't remember anything she said. So one night, while he was on the phone talking about the water, she painted his toenails to get him to pay attention to her. And it worked. The polish was flaking off, but still there. A month later, Elon and I had lunch, meeting at our favorite diner. It was April, and a lot was still happening in Flint. The final Five Guys report had come out the month before, spelling out in harsh terms the negligence and willful disregard for health, particularly by MDEQ. Brad Werfel had lost his job in December, right after Christmas, the same day his boss, Dan Wyant, resigned. In the past 6 months, more than 50 lawsuits had been filed, and the first criminal charges were announced against two state officials, Stephen Bush and Mike Prisby, in the drinking water division of MDEQ. There were 6 charges altogether, including misleading the EPA, manipulating water sampling, and tampering with reports. MDEQ received the most indictments and charges. Besides Bush and Prisby, the top drinking water regulator, Leanne Schechter-Smith, was fired. 3 members of the MDHHS epidemiology and lead staff, Corinne Miller, Bob Scott, and Nancy Peeler, were charged with actively covering up the spike in blood lead level data. I never learned why nurse Karen Lischinski failed to follow up with me. She was never accused of wrongdoing, but her superiors at the state lead surveillance program were. Down the road, MDHHS Director Nick Lyon and Eden Wells were charged, related to the Legionnaires' disease outbreak. Wells was charged with obstruction of justice, Lyon with misconduct. Both were charged with involuntary manslaughter, along with 3 others, Bush, Howard Croft, and Schechter-Smith, for their failure to act in the crisis. The criminal complaint against Lyon included a reference to his email to subordinates asking them to make a strong statement with a demonstration of proof that the blood lead levels seen are not out of the ordinary. Susan Hedman, the director of EPA Region 5, where Miguel worked, resigned in January 2016. A scathing report by the agency's inspector general said that the EPA should have acted 7 months sooner. This prompted Representative Kildee to lead a charge to pass a bipartisan bill that requires the EPA to notify the public any time lead is found in the water supply. Flint officials weren't spared. City manager Natasha Henderson was fired in February. Howard Croft lost his job and was charged with 2 additional felonies, false pretenses and conspiracy to commit false pretenses in connection with the water crisis. Another Flint city official, Mike Glasgow, was accused of tampering with a lead report. Later, Flint emergency manager Darnell Early was charged with involuntary manslaughter. Dane Walling, who lost his bid for re-election just 6 weeks after my press conference, was the first political casualty of the crisis. I have often suspected that if he'd been on the right side of the fight and had skipped his chance to meet the Pope, things would have been different. Today, he regularly expresses regret about his role. Governor Snyder survived his own crash in the polls and was not forced to resign. But his reputation is tarnished, and he appears to have abandoned thoughts of seeking higher office. Many people asked me, shouldn't the governor go to jail? Truth and reconciliation and restorative justice are part of healing, and investigations are important. But the law is not my job. My focus is on the health and well-being of Flint kids. Accountability is another matter. In D.C., it is what Mark Edwards hoped for but never received. The D.C. water crisis took a decade to be resolved, and unsatisfactorily. Negligent and deceitful government employees and water utility executives never paid a price, were never charged with a crime, never even lost their jobs. Most of the children in D.C. who were affected, potentially 42,000 of them, were never compensated or even made aware of what had happened. When Mark came to Flint, he despaired that his work wouldn't make a difference, even though he was committed to doing all he could. It was this sense of resignation and even bitterness that I saw in his eyes and face the first time we met in September. And when he looked across the table and said, "I trust you," the leap he was taking was obvious. This was a man who had been undermined, lied to, and dismissed by public health experts for years, but who never gave up on his mission. After our initial meeting at the farmer's market, hundreds of emails passed between Mark and me, both curses and celebrations. He became a fixture in my life, like a long-lost brother. But it would be another 2 months before we met again face-to-face. We were both in D.C. for a meeting of the EPA Drinking Water Committee, at which the existing lead and copper rule was up for discussion. It was our chance to advocate for strengthening the rule. We wanted the EPA to finally force utilities to methodologically optimize corrosion control and replace the lead pipes. On our way to the hearing, Mark was stopped by a woman who recognized him. She had graying hair and looked worn and tired. She said she was an activist in D.C. and had a son who was a baby during the lead exposure. A teenager now, the boy's learning and behavioral problems were significant. There is not a day that goes by that I don't wonder if it was the D.C. water that impacted my son, she said, then thanked Mark for his work. As a mom and a pediatrician, my heart ached for her. I wondered when we were going to learn from our past mistakes, when our policies would finally catch up with science. Science tells us that there is no safe level of lead. All the federal lead exposure standards are out of date. Rulemaking for something so crucial should not take almost a decade. Every day, children are trapped and held hostage by bureaucratic governmental processes. We know the right policies and practices to eliminate lead exposure for all children. And we even know the economic benefit. But we continue to kick the can down the road, putting the future of our most vulnerable kids at risk. As Mark and I walked on, I kept thinking about that activist mom. And I knew that years from now, Flint moms would surely wonder the same thing. How much lead was my child exposed to? And what did it do to her? At the hearing, the EPA allowed us to make a case for a stronger lead and copper rule in 2-minute allotments. A bunch of us were there. Representative Kildee, Senator Ananick, Leanne Walters, Kurt Guyette, and others. After the testimony, Mark and I headed to Capitol Hill to continue our advocacy. We first went to Kildee's office for a meeting, where we ran into legendary water warrior Aaron Brockovich. And then we went on to see Senator Gary Peters before going our separate ways. Mark had a class to teach remotely. I had a meeting with Senator Stabenow, who had kept her promise and in record time paved the way to make ready-to-feed formula available for all Flint babies, like Nicola. Just before we parted, Mark said, "Can I speak to you?" and pulled me into a small room in Senator Peters' office. During the day, I had noticed he seemed a little strung out and preoccupied. Aside from his 2-minute testimony to the EPA, he had been quiet. Was it hard for him to be back in D.C., I wondered, where he undoubtedly had so many bad memories? "You are amazing at this," he said as soon as we were alone. "Do you know that?" I was embarrassed and wanted to stop him, deny what he was saying, be humble, dismiss it, change the subject, and remind him that this was part of my job. This was what pediatricians were supposed to do, what we took an oath to do. But I'll confess, it also felt good to bask in the sunshine of this compliment, coming from a man who had been in the trenches, been an activist for kids, fought harder and longer than I had, and put more on the line. What he was saying, really, was that I could do things he couldn't. Spread hope, bring people together, control a room. His heart and his science were in the right place, but he wasn't an organizer or an optimist. It wasn't really what I had achieved that impressed him. It was what we had all achieved together. We were, as he said, a dream team. It wasn't lost on either of us that we were lucky to be able to speak out, that we had the support and academic freedom of the public land-grant universities where we taught and did research. Both Michigan State and Virginia Tech had our backs and urged us on. Mark continued, probably sensing how much it meant to me. "I connected with audiences," he said. "I connected emotionally. I made people feel engaged and angry and ready to help, ready to fight." "You are a force of nature," he said. Not long afterward, he gave me a necklace made from a slice of lead pipe that came from a DC home where a child had high lead levels. And the city kept denying that any plumbing in the house contained lead until the pipe was dug up. When he gave it to me, plated in gold, he said he hoped it would be a constant reminder of my commitment to all kids. I keep it with me always, wherever I go. Elin and I ordered lunch and chatted in that casual old friend's way about parents, kids, schools. Sitting across from her, I noticed she seemed lighter. Her manner was easier. She was more like her younger self, her high school and college self. Her years in D.C., the dismay, the disturbing realization that environmental protection can mean all kinds of things, including butt covering, pointless exercises, and pro-industry agendas, had left her burdened and puzzled. She had carried around a sense of disappointment in life, a kind of existential dissatisfaction. But now, that heavy air around her had cleared. 8 months had passed since the noisy barbecue at my house where she cornered me to tell me about the water in Flint. It seemed like a lifetime ago. It almost felt like we were both new people now, older and wiser, but also younger and more hopeful. I had spent the better part of these months in meetings, giving interviews and speeches. I had seen Mark many more times over the winter and spring, at hearings, Flint water meetings, and various functions where we shared our accounts of the Flint story. Time magazine cited us in its annual list of the world's most influential people. And most memorably for Mom Evelyn, I received a Detroit Pistons jersey with my name on it during a halftime show. All the recognition was largely awkward. I often feel like a broken record, always repeating that I was doing my job, adhering to an oath I had taken when I became a doctor, and that my activism on behalf of Flint and the kids of Flint is a privilege full of its own rewards that have nothing to do with awards. Although I wouldn't wish the state's attack machine on anyone, my woes are nothing compared to the daily deprivations inflicted on the people of Flint, who at this time still do not have drinkable tap water. They are the heroes of this crisis. What I liked most was the chance to explain, to share the latest developments in Flint, to tell the stories, and to track the lessons. I hope that somehow what happened, the resistance, the science advocacy, and the coalition building, inspires others to fight the injustices around them. I told you, Elliot liked to say, I told you that you could do it, that you'd find a way to fight for Flint kids, and you did. You never said that, I liked to respond, as stubbornly as possible, and it always made him laugh. In early March, he'd had another operation on his shoulder, to repair the mistakes made in the botched first surgery, and he was recovering quickly this time, and making plans to build a treehouse in our backyard. Nina and Layla still complained that I was gone too much and traveling too much, but they were happily obsessed with Simba, an emotionally needy rescue cat that followed them all over the house, never leaving them alone. Mark stayed with us during his frequent pilgrimages to Michigan, where he served on various committees and continued water sampling. By then, he wasn't just my close friend. He was a good friend to my entire clan. My brother, the girls, Simba, and was carefully monitoring Elliot's progress on his treehouse plans. And even though the road to clean tap water in Flint would take years, and the people of Flint still had a lot of suffering ahead, Mark always says that what happened here, in contrast to D.C., was a miracle, something he would never have believed possible. Doctors aren't really supposed to be mystical, but sometimes the whole thing had a meant-to-be feeling, starting with the wild coincidence that Elin had been right there at the EPA throughout the D.C. crisis. Water treatment engineers aren't supposed to be mystical either. Before Flint, my career was a total mystery to me, Elin confessed at lunch. None of it made sense. So many times I have looked back at my choices and career moves and wondered, what was I thinking? But now I see that each move was a piece in the puzzle, so that I could be standing right there in your kitchen at exactly the right time. It all makes sense to me now. There was a point to all those twists and turns. This was a daunting revelation coming from a woman so confident and strong. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that Elin's description really described my own life. Like lots of young people, I was drawn to advocacy, but the chance to really do something meaningful had come by accident. I was the right person, in the right job, with the right set of skills, with the right team, who saw a chance to make a difference. For me to push through and succeed, many random aspects of my life came into play and helped me. From the resilience of my long-dead ancestors and the courage of my progressive family, to my many mentors who fostered my environmental activism, which started in high school and grew in college, and my background in hardcore science. The Flint water crisis never should have happened. It was entirely preventable. And when the water supply was switched and not properly treated, it should have ended when the residents raised their voices and their jugs of brown water. I certainly wasn't the most important piece of the Flint puzzle. So many others. Leanne, Miguel, Elin, and Mark. The dozens of tireless Flint activists and local journalists were instrumental and critical. I was just the last piece. The state wouldn't stop lying until somebody came along to prove that real harm was being done to kids. Then the house of cards fell. I finally had a chance to talk to Bunyan Bryant, the environmental justice pioneer, when I received the Michigan Environmental Council's Distinguished Service Award, named after environmentalist and former Michigan governor William Milliken. The last time I'd seen Bunyan was more than a decade earlier at my brother's wedding to Annette, an environmental lawyer who's even closer to Bunyan. Bunyan's family is still in Flint, and his lifelong fight for justice buzzed through my mind as I talked a mile a minute about the Flint water crisis with him. He is suffering from Parkinson's now. His wife tells me he has good days and bad. I had the great fortune of seeing him on a good day. Always the professor, he had some keen observations to share. I knew he was thinking about all the places plagued by ongoing environmental injustice, including the many communities with lead contamination much worse than Flint's. He couldn't quite respond a mile a minute, but I knew his sharp mind was taking everything in. Bunyan's lifetime achievements and contributions in environmental justice gave me, and all of us, a way to see the Flint crisis through his eyes, and a framework and language to understand it. Truly an enduring legacy. Mostly, I wanted to thank him. Throughout the Flint crisis, I stood on the shoulders of giants. Incredible giants I intimately worked with, like Mark Edwards. And giants who walked a long time ago, like Alice Hamilton and Jon Snow, who paved the way. Bunyan Bryant is definitely one of them. Chapter 26. Prescription for Hope. Nicola came to the clinic for her 18-month checkup in October 2016. Reva spotted me in the hallway while her baby sister was being weighed. Dr. Mona, we saw you on TV. I waved her over, lifted her up, and squeezed her tight. Holding her hand, we walked over to the bookshelf and looked at newly stocked Reach Out and Read books. We grabbed a couple, including a Richard Scarry classic for Nicola. Back in the exam room, I smiled at Grace, their young mom. She seemed more grown up, more confident somehow. She and I had more of a relationship than I have with most of my patients. I met her when Nicola was just 4 months old, the week I learned about the Flint water, and somehow those memories are seared together in my mind. When I thought of the babies of Flint, I always thought of sweet Nicola, who was now a chubby, happy, walking and talking toddler. I had done a lot of apologizing to Grace a year earlier. I told you the water was fine for Nicola's formula. And it wasn't, I had said, I'm so sorry. I had no idea. Moms are always right. Every parent should listen to that primal instinct to protect their kids. I knew it wasn't fine, Grace replied, much to my relief. My auntie told me. She's Nicola's godmother, and her water was brown and smelled. My water seemed okay, but my auntie told me not to use it. I said, I can't afford bottled water, so she bought it for me. Allison and I had seen Nicola for her checkups when she was 6, 9, 12, and 15 months old. Over the year, Grace mixed her formula with bottled water that she got from her auntie, then from her church, the food bank, and the National Guard. She cooked Reva's meals with it, too. The medical assistant came to take Reva for her blood draw. She was getting her lead level checked. Her first lead level, taken the year before, was high. 26 micrograms per deciliter. And now she was getting it checked again. After that, she'd have her hearing and vision checked and get a $10 prescription for fruit and veggies at the Flint Farmers Market, which becomes $20 with the Flint expansion of Double Up Food Bucks. As soon as they left, Grace let down her guard and gave me an all-too-familiar look of fear, anxiety, and guilt. Is she going to be okay? She asked. Both of them. Are they going to be okay? Reva was 3 years old that autumn. She had been drinking contaminated water most of her life, during the most critical period of brain development. And even though Nicola was spared the water in her formula, Grace had drunk it during her pregnancy. A year before, their water at home had been checked and found to be 150 parts per billion, something Grace would never have known on her own, because lead in water is colorless, odorless, and tasteless. At their auntie's house, it was 3,000 ppb, and a neighbor down the street had a level of 13,000 ppb. Putting this into perspective, 15 ppb is the federal action level, and that's set too high. And 5,000 ppb is the hazardous waste level. Drinking Flint water after the water switch was like drinking through a lead straw. You never knew when a piece of severely corroding lead scale would break off and fall into the drinking water and into the bodies of our children. When I found out that a group home for abused and neglected kids near the hospital had a water lead level over 5,000 ppb, I was the maddest and saddest I'd ever been in my life. These kids literally had every adversity possible. It was like the world was conspiring to keep them down. Grace worried a lot, and there were days when she looked terrorized and down. I couldn't blame her. Every day in Flint, our families had been waking up to a nightmare of water contamination. Betrayal by every governmental agency charged with protecting them, and years of neglect and poverty. Many of the families who want to call it quits and leave Flint can't sell their homes because the home values have tanked. Those who remain feel angry at everyone almost every day. It is community-wide PTSD. The mental health problems are now just as serious as the physical ones. My family came to the United States basically as refugees fleeing oppression, in search of a peaceful and prosperous place for my brother and me to grow up. The American dream worked for us. But sitting with Nicola in my lap, I realized that America has changed a lot since I was a little girl. Yes, people are still running to America, or at least trying to. It remains the epitome of prosperity for the entire world, the richest country that ever was. But there really are two Americas, aren't there? The America I was lucky to grow up in, and the other America, the one I see in my clinic every day. In that other America, I have seen things I wish I'd never seen. The things you run from, not toward. Things that would never be part of any dream. And for too many people, this nightmare is taking place right outside their front door. Sometimes I joke that I was born an activist. But it's not really a joke. I was born into a family that was on the move towards something better. And I was born into a life knowing there is injustice in the world and the importance of fighting it. And that's exactly what my babies in Flint are born into. Sweet little ones like Nicola. For them, life is a struggle from the very beginning. That can make a baby a fighter. Because for Nicola and Riva, every little thing, sometimes things as simple as a meal or clean water or a bath, can require a fight. Where is the American dream in this scenario? It's not there. It's not even talked about. It is becoming so out of reach. Income and wealth inequality make mobility tough. Stagnation is now the norm. At the end of their lives, most children wind up where they started. Not just Flint kids, but children in Detroit and Los Angeles and Chicago and Baltimore and all over rural America. Black, brown, and white. Too many kids are growing up in situations stacked with insurmountable toxic stresses and every barrier imaginable. Too many kids are growing up in a nation that does not value their future or even try to offer them a better one. That's not how it's supposed to be. The dream shouldn't have to come by way of a miracle. It should come fairly to all and be big enough for everybody to achieve. The environment shouldn't be stacked against anybody, especially our kids. We owe it to them and to one another. As a doctor, what can I prescribe for our sons and daughters of the other America? This is what I thought about that day with Grace when she asked me about her girls and if they were going to be okay. Nicola was still snuggling on my lap. What can I do? Grace asked. Keep doing everything you are already doing. Love them. Talk to them. Sing to them. Read to them. Give them great food, I replied. I encouraged her to fill the nutrition prescriptions downstairs at the farmer's market for fresh produce, and I urged her to sign up for WIC. There was a special Medicaid expansion and universal early intervention development support offered to Flint kids. You've also been getting the home delivery of kids' books every month, right? Mental health support is nothing to be ashamed of, I said. So here is a number to the trauma crisis line if you need it. Don't forget about the mindfulness workshops. They have them in the schools now, too. Parenting support classes are being held on Tuesdays, and they even do home visits. I took a breath and said, and make sure you come visit me often. Grace applied for a preschool aid job at Flint's new child care center, one that pays well, more than $17.50 an hour, with health care benefits and a 401k. It was a new position made available with state money. She was sticking with Flint. This intervention of a good job, a living wage job, is one of the best I can think of. And these recovery jobs, the return of the grand bargain, will be critical for Flint and places like Flint everywhere. Nicola and Riva are growing so fast right now, I went on. Their brains are growing so much. And no matter what badness they may have been exposed to, we can overcome it with all this goodness. We are trying to tip the scale, and we will. The most important medication that I can prescribe is hope. Nicola moved around in my lap, a little restless. Her eyes were wide open, and she followed my voice and my every move. Her fingers were tightly wrapped around mine. I lifted her up and told her she was going to be fine. She was mixed up in an accident. A lot of kids were, but it wasn't her fault. And it's my job to make sure she and her sister and all the kids in Flint are okay. Actually, it's my job to make sure they have every chance in the world to be better than okay. To be great. Epilogue. Haji and the Birds. One night, I'm working late, and I hear Bibi helping Elliot get the girls ready for bed. Nina says she isn't sleepy and never wants to go to bed. Layla pretends not to hear. She is dressing Simba. Poor cat. There is a long silence, followed by movement in the hallway. Bibi, in her quietly persistent way, inches them toward sleep by offering to tell them a story. Nina doesn't really need anybody to read to her anymore. She's a bookworm in her own right. Elliot and I still love the bedtime reading ritual, though, because there is nothing like bedtime cuddling while bonding over a story. And research on early development has shown how critical it is to little kids. Reading to kids is brain food. But this year, as well as last, Elliot still has the most chances to put the girls to bed. It's something I miss. As soon as the girls settle in, I hear Bibi's gentle voice begin. She isn't reading a book. She's telling the story of Haji wa'al-Asafir, Haji and the birds. It's a family fable that has been passed down, a story my mom heard from her father, Haji, when she was little, and later used to tell Mark and me. It is about a young man named Haji, but we all know my grandfather was that young man, which makes it more vivid and intense. Layla, you don't remember your great-grandfather, Bibi is saying in Arabic. But Nina does, don't you? I've seen pictures of him, Bibi, Layla calls out in her husky voice. I know him. He was a special person, Bibi goes on. When I think of him, he gives me strength. He was honest and kind. He was generous. Oh, yeah, Layla calls out. I remember the story Mama told us about how he helped his workers, and then they helped him. That's right, Bibi says. Haji loved everybody, but especially he loved kids. He had 5 kids, so there was a lot of love in my house when I was a girl at your age. At night in the summer, instead of sleeping in our bedrooms, everyone slept on the roof, the tharma, where it was cool. That's what people in Baghdad used to do, and still do. I wouldn't like that, Layla says. Maybe you would, Bibi answers in Arabic, if you tried it. And before we all fell asleep, Haji used to cuddle with us and tell us this story. Haji Jassim and the birds, says Layla. That's it, says Bibi. You have heard it before, but you need to hear it many times. Because someday you'll be telling the story to your own children and your grandchildren. They'll all come to know Haji that way and the things he cared about and thought were important. After a short pause, she starts. Once upon a time in Baghdad, there was a young man named Haji. He loved nature. He loved flowers. At his house, he had a garden of citrus trees and date palms, pomegranate trees, and flowers. Most of all, he loved birds. He loved their freedom. He loved the sounds of their singing. Blackbirds, white birds, yellow birds, big birds, and very little birds. Every morning he opened the window to hear their different songs. He loved the cooing of pigeons. He loved the chirping of little sparrows. Each song was different and separate, but together the birds made a beautiful symphony. Every morning, he walked outside with a bowl of grains and rice and seeds. He made a feast for the birds. They would fly down, and Haji liked to watch them eat his feast, then drink from the flowers. He became friends with them all. Some birds even ate from the palm of his hand. The garden was such a simple and peaceful place. One day, after feeding the birds, Haji climbed a ladder to pick dates from a palm tree. And reaching for a branch slightly too high, he fell off and broke his leg. He called out for help, called and called, but nobody came. A small bird flew down and tugged at the hem of his white dishdasha. The bird told Haji that he would take him to the doctor. But Haji laughed at the small bird, wondering how such a tiny bird could carry him. Soon, another bird came and took the edge of his sleeve. Another bird came, and another, until hundreds of birds surrounded him. They each held a small piece of his dishdasha, and even his hair and his toes, and together the birds were able to lift him and fly him through the air. They flew over the palm trees, the majestic meandering tigress, the statues of the ancient poets and